Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Fan Experience Experience podcast series. Each of these podcasts will explore a different element of the fan experience and the theme of fan engagement. Some of them will look at the match day experience, while others will look at more broader themes. But every podcast will deliver relevant value to anyone listening in football, or indeed any other spectator sport. Whether it's general advice you're looking for or ways to help you start a conversation with your colleagues, then wherever you work in football, we reckon that a regular dose of the fan experience will make a difference.
Do you think we should start with some introductions, Mark?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay, you go first.
Well, I'm a lifelong Sunderland fan for my sins, since first being taken to Roker Park in 1969 by my dad as a punishment for being naughty. And since then, I've followed the downs and downs of the club until recent days, where we're now Netflix stars. But in terms of the company, my other half, Anna, and I founded the Fan Experience Company 15 years ago. And since then, we've been helping federations, leagues and clubs to grow more sustainably by improving the fan experience. And back to you, Darren.
Well, I've been involved in those match day assessments for quite a number of years now. But in 2017, and with our programme of match day experience assessments growing across Europe, I've been involved with the Fan Experience Company on a full-time basis. And when I'm not working on football, I'm a Walsall fan. I went to my first match in 1982, and we are proudly one of the, well, not one of, we are the team that has spent most time in League One of any club in the Football League, and I've been to most of them.
The plan is that each of the podcasts will have a special guest. But before we introduce this first guest, let's take a more detailed look at why the fan experience is so important. Darren, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, since getting involved about 3 years ago now with you and the Fan Experience Company, I think the best thing that I've learned is that you just cannot separate the fan experience and attracting more people and higher attendances to games. If you put on a great experience, people will want to come back, even if the result doesn't quite go the right way. But if the experience is bad, then unless the team is winning all of the time, it just won't get fans to want to come back.
Yeah, and of course, it's important, especially in these times during this horrible pandemic, that clubs are actually prepared to face a new world where people will want a lot more entertainment value for their pound, their euro, their dollar, or their krona. And I guess that's one of the reasons why it's important to understand what do we mean when we say fan engagement. Because fan engagement is something in which fan experience is part of. You know, we talk about fan engagement as a wider philosophy. We don't just mean entertainment. What we mean is everything that a club does, it could be a league or an association, but anything they do to protect, respect and nurture the emotional investment that fans have in it. So for me, that's the wider thing. It's about that emotional connection. I was on a podcast the other day, a webinar at Football Club Barcelona, and they were asking me to define fan engagement. And one of the people on the webinar was talking about Disney and how football can learn from Disney. But I guess the thing that Disney does is that it builds absolutely everything it does around looking after its customers and delighting them. It's in its DNA. That's why Disney exists. It exists to look after the people that come and enjoy its parks. Football exists to actually win. And so when we talk about fan engagement, we're actually talking about something that we want football to head towards, to get to a situation where actually thinking about the fans, what they need, how we keep their emotional loyalty, how we keep their trust. And as I say, it's much bigger than just, say, the halftime entertainment we put on or the digital engagement we put on to keep them entertained between games.
Well, that's the other thing I've picked up, is that they all have to link. And I know that we're going to talk about all of the different touch points in the fan experience over the podcast series. But the most important thing for me is that they all join together. Because there's very little point in having a fan zone at one part of the stadium that's doing a great job if at another part of the experience, for example, car park stewards are being rude to fans as they arrive. So I think that's a really important part of it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And this is not just existing fans. You know, existing fans already have that emotional connection. But we know that if clubs are to grow, only part of that growth can come from their existing fan base. You know, and lapsed fans, a lot of that growth has got to come from new people. You might have family with kids who love watching games on TV, who want to go to a live match. But that mum or that dad or that carer will have perceptions. They might believe that football is not actually family friendly. So you're quite right. You've got to take care of every single touch point throughout that match day experience.
And there's those younger fans as well, Mark. So the kids from 11 to 16 or 17 who, you know, football at the moment doesn't really cater very well for that particular group. So we know from all the work we do that there's some fantastic things go on for families and particularly younger children. But what happens when they get to senior school and have lots of other interests?
No, it's true. I mean, you know, my son, I was talking to him the other day about his friends. They all describe themselves as football fans. They all love football. But out of five of them, I think he's the only one that actually would describe himself as match attending, you know, going along to watch Bradford City. I think of the other four, one streams football, another one plays FIFA, another one puts the odd pound on an acre of a Saturday, and I think another one does fantasy football. So, you know, I think outside of the elite, clubs have a huge challenge to get people to come and experience that match day. Part of it is to do with managing perceptions, but as we know, a big part of it is creating an experience so that however hard you work to market that experience, the experience itself doesn't let you down. The experience makes you want to come back. You know, we've seen that in women's football in particular, a hell of a lot of interest and investment in marketing the sport. But as Megan Rapinoe said quite recently, you know, you've got to make people want to come to the game. There's got to be a great experience. Once they come once, you want them to come again. And again, at this point of the podcast, it's worth mentioning that we have actually been lucky enough to win a couple of awards. Back in 2013, the European Professional Leagues Association gave us a Best Practice Award. And in the Sport Business Awards back in 2018, our EFL Family Excellence Scheme was also given an award. We're very, very proud of that. So that takes us to this episode. And this is the very first podcast that we've done. And what we aim to do, you know, over this series is, as Darren has said, we're going to look at some of the individual touch points, the parts of the match day experience that we've got to get right, whether it's refreshments, whether it's inside the stadium, even things like signage and information on the website. And we'll have a range of experts and practitioners who are going to join us from all over Europe, in fact. But we'll also have a series of specials. And in these specials, we'll look at the particular perspective of people, such as a chief executive. How does he or she maintain a focus on fans? How do they foster a spirit of engagement? And I guess even more importantly, what do they do with themselves on a match day? Do they spend all of the time up in hospitality, or do they spend time with fans? So this very first one, I guess it's a third type. It's a very special. It's a special special because it's actually our very, very first episode. And we wanted a guest who, for us, was the perfect person to start with. And a couple of years ago, you know, when we were working together, we realized that there was actually one legendary player who played for each of the clubs that we support. I'm a Sunderland fan, as I've said. Darren is the best centre forward that Walsall never had. And finally, our producer, Juan Luis, is a Bradford City fan. So our first guest is none other than the legendary Don Goodman. Don, welcome to the podcast.
Well, hello, everybody. And may I say what a privilege it is to be your honorary president and what a privilege it is to be on your very, very first podcast. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. What are you doing with yourself right now, Don? Because, you know, as well as having a 12-13 club career, you're obviously involved in broadcasting and, you know, commenting, expert commentary on games. How are you spending your time right now?
Probably the same way that most people are. I am probably training harder than I've trained for about 5 or 6 years, to be honest. That's good. I feel fit and I feel healthy. And then it's about catching up on the menial jobs, really, that I've always put off in the past in favour of going to the golf course usually. So it's afforded me an opportunity to get a little healthier and to get some old jobs done.
Well, you know, and of course, it's not just because, you know, we loved you as a footballer. But there's another reason why we wanted you to be our honorary president. And that goes back to, you know, conversation that you and I had a couple of years ago. And then, Darren, you met Don last year. Do you want to take up the story?
Yeah, I mean, I met Don for the first time at Birmingham City at one of our end-of-season events for the EFL programme that you've mentioned. And Don, I was just blown away, I guess, when you got up to speak at that event and talked about the player perspective and how important the fan experience and fans in general were to players. And that was a real eye-opener, because obviously we see everything from the fans' perspective. So I guess, you know, a good starting point was, could you just expand on what you said on that occasion?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, we have to acknowledge that when something is taken away from us, we realise how much we miss it, don't we? And we've all had this wonderful game of football that we miss, sadly taken away from us for a period. And, you know, it's never been lost on me the influence that having fans in stadiums has in terms of its impact, positive and negative, on players from the supporters. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have some amazing positive experiences with fans and you know, felt loved by football fans. So the fact that football will begin again, initially it will be behind closed doors, because the health of everybody has to be the most important factor. And I think there's going to be an awful lot of footballers who are really, really going to appreciate the impact of the football fan when the fans are allowed. I can actually imagine players just being so pleased and so happy to have football fans back in the stadium, because they are the lifeblood. They always have been, and they always will be. And you know, it was, you know, I first came across you, Mark, 2 or 3 years ago. I'm privileged enough to be sitting on the EFL judging panel for the EFL Awards with you. And I have to say, the first time I did it was a real eye-opener. There were a couple of areas that really stood out to me. One was the work that football clubs do in the communities, in their respective communities. I mean, it's remarkable what they do and actually don't get the publicity or recognition for. And the other is the work that you guys do in, you know, making and aspiring to make attending football matches the best experience that it can possibly be. And, you know, the fact that you are now here inviting me on to speak about fan engagement and the fan experience is an absolute pleasure, because I've seen the fruits of your labour at certain grounds around the country. And, you know, it's a very, very different experience to when I was growing up, where it was predominantly a male environment that would stand on terraces, go to the pub before, sing songs, go to the pub after, and that was it. It's so much more than that now in terms of families attending. I heard you, Darren, talking about actually that age category 11 to 17, I think you said, mm-hmm. and how vital that is. And it is vital. And we need the help of the parents, you know. I think we need the help of the parents, because, you know, there's no getting away from the fact that we are all influenced by our parents. So, you know, I think to encourage parents to make it a family occasion rather than the dad just going off on his own is something that we need to encourage. And the fact that all this brilliant work by all the football clubs in what goes on behind the scenes, what's available, the quality of everything, the fact that that just seems to be getting better and better and better and better, hopefully will help us attract those that age group and more.
Most of it, in fact, the family thing, from what we've discovered, Don, is that a lot of it is to do with perceptions. You know, there have been, you know, many families I've spoken to where one of the parents is a fanatical football fan, but they've given up going to the game because they can't make a good enough business case to their other half that it's kind of safe for kids. And that's all built on perceptions. You know, they assume that because each football club has a really noisy group of passionate fans in one part of the ground, that means that it's actually, you know, socially dangerous place to be, that you should be, you know, avoiding football at all costs. So I think the work that we've done with the EFL and the Family Excellence Scheme has been clearly aimed at helping the clubs to improve the experience for families. But the you know, the underlying message is that we want to change perceptions. The more that things like, you know, clubs can demonstrate that they've won they've met the Family Excellence Standard, or they're one of those few clubs at Middlesbrough, Doncaster Rovers, Millwall, you know, who've won the Family Club of the Year award. And what that does for us is it actually, you know, signals to the world out there that football has changed. It's not been left behind. It actually has changed. And I guess looking at it from that point, you actually experienced a time in football when, you know, like you said before, you would be with fans, when players weren't so detached from fans. And, you know, we're not talking about Premier League here. We're talking about, you know, EFL level or most of the leagues across Europe, when perhaps players have grown into thinking that detachment is actually part of the life of being a footballer. And I'm really interested in what you said about, you know, the importance about players actually playing a part in engagement. And do you think that's really important?
Oh, 100%. I mean, look, when I'm often asked, people come up to me all the time, guys, and say, I bet you wish you were playing now with all the money in the game, et cetera, et cetera. And my answer is simply, I wouldn't swap it. For a variety of reasons, you know, like the characters that I encountered and also the fan interaction. That was one of the big things. As I've already alluded to, I was fortunate enough to be pretty popular at most of the clubs that I played for. And, you know, we used to drink in the same pubs. We used to eat in the same restaurants, go to the same places. And there was an awful lot of fan interaction in those days. I think modern day players probably live in a little bit more of a bubble, you know, and I guess, you know, this horrible pandemic where so many people are losing loved ones and so on and so forth, I hope it puts things in perspective for the world, really, in that, you know, communities are coming together now. Every Thursday we clap our NHS. We really value and appreciate our NHS more now than ever before. And I, for one, hope that that tradition continues forever and ever, so that we never lose sight of how good and how important and what heroes the people that work in the NHS and social care are for us. And one of the things is, I think players will undoubtedly really appreciate football supporters. I think they will long, when they're playing behind closed doors, as I've already alluded to have supporters back. And, you know, maybe it will encourage them to be a little bit more personal with football fans. You know, stop and have photographs, stop and sign autographs, stop and say hello, yeah, have a chat. And almost humanise players again, really, because there are certainly an awful lot of grounds where you can't get anywhere near the players, you know. And it was a big thing when I was playing and growing up, before the game, you know, walking from the car to into the player's entrance, people would stop, have photos, have autographs, chew the fat with you. Doesn't seem to happen too much these days. And of course, again, after games where you can interact, good or bad, you know, because you, throughout your career, you're bound to get positive and negative results. But yeah, I for one hope that this pandemic and this situation that we find ourselves in just encourages, you know, all the players to fully appreciate the supporters that, let's not be blunt about it, love and idolise them.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, I mean, obviously part of the work we do, we often encourage clubs to utilise the squad, the playing squad, as much as possible in the fan experience, and some clubs do it better than others. But I remember one club in the EFL making a really great point, and this was the CEO saying, "Look, you know, there's 25, 26 players in our squad, and only 18 of them can get changed on a Saturday or whatever day it is, and therefore there's a number of players who are still paid by the club and still part of the club that aren't actually in the match day squad and could be doing things that engage with fans, and they'd started to do that, and the results were fantastic."
There's one example there, Donna, was that Darren and I both come across is Middlesbrough. One of the things that Middlesbrough have done, obviously they've been really close to their community. The club nearly disappeared in the mid 80s, as you know. There's always been a special bond with the fans there. And one of the things that they do with injured or squad players is invite them to take part in the first time fan experience. And what that is that if you're booking for a kid for the first time, if the team at Borough notice that there's a child in the booking, then they'll offer you a chance to get to the club maybe an hour and a half before kickoff and get a personal tour of the facilities. And, you know, one day you hopefully you'll get a chance to see the Generation Z zone up there for families. It's huge. It stretches down one side of the stadium. It's always full, regardless of how well Borough are doing. And part of that experience often includes being welcomed at the turnstile for that tour by an actual player at the club. You know, and they've got some really good community players there. There's that. There's also the way that clubs have cottoned on to an idea that actually came from Tom, who's actually the commercial director of Bristol Rovers now. When he was at Portsmouth many years ago, and when they were having a Sunderland time, you know, slipping down through the leagues, there was a family there that he saw at every single game. 45 minutes before kickoff, he walked over to them and said, listen, you know, really appreciate your loyalty. We're not actually, you know, delivering the goods for you, yet you're still here. And he instinctively thought that it would be a nice thing to do to sit them in the dugout during the pre-match warm-up. And I think, you know, Tom would have probably underestimated just how important that was. He knew he was doing them a favour. He knew it was special. But it's sacred ground. You know, you sat there, you're watching your heroes in front of you, you know, warming up half an hour before kickoff. The chances that one of them might, you know, ruffle your kid's hair or stop for a picture as they walk off the pitch to get ready for the game. Then at Brentford, they've got a wonderful idea where they have kids in the family stand. They get to actually write messages on a huge A1 piece of paper, like a flip chart paper. They draw messages and little pictures, and those messages are actually taken into the dressing room. So Thomas Frank, the team manager, can actually show them to the player. And when the Brentford, my friend at Brentford, Ryan Morant, first suggested this to the manager, he said that, you know, listen, don't bring it in 45 minutes before kickoff. I want to show the players 10 minutes before kickoff. You know, so you've got, there's a lot of really fantastic things going on. And when we look at clubs, it's often the fact that they're just not telling people about it. You know, so part of it is doing it and part of it is letting people know about it.
So, you know what strikes me there, my friend? All of those three little scenarios that you've just painted, they actually cost the clubs absolutely nothing. And it is the little touches, the little things like that, that make all the difference. And player interaction, it's huge. Like you said about a player ruffling a little one's head, I used to do that an awful lot. I used to make sure that mascots were felt special, because it is a special thing being a mascot. And I used to make sure that I had time for them. And I'll never forget growing up, I was a ball boy at Elland Road as a young'un. And in those days, the players used a communal toilet in the corridor. And ball boys did as well. And I'll never forget, I won't bore you with the details or go into too much detail, but I'm standing there, my afro gets ruffled from behind, and I turn around, and it was a Liverpool player, David Hodgson. Leeds United were playing Liverpool that day. It was a big game, and he talked to me and asked me questions and ruffled my hair. And I'll tell you what, I never forgot that, Mark. And that was something that made me feel 10 foot tall. And therefore, when I actually made it as a professional, that was I was going to take what David Hodgson had done to me, how he had inspired me, because I remember how it made me feel, and transfer that to the kids that were coming to watch football whilst I was playing. And I think you're right. You know, you're talking about more and more players getting involved pre and post match. I think it's a magic because that's who the people are there to see, aren't they? They're there to see the players. And unfortunately, like you said, Darren, they can't all be on the pitch at the same time. So there is an opportunity for football clubs to utilise the remaining members of the squad, whether they're injured or just not quite made it into that initial 18-man squad, that to be more proactive with the fans that are in the stadium.
It's funny you should mention David Hodgson, Don, because I studied Spanish at Sheffield University, and while I was there, I was getting ready to go and see the League Cup final in 1985, a long time ago, when Sunderland played Norwich, and in typical style, we scored an own goal, we missed a penalty, we lost, and then got relegated 3 weeks later. So that, you know, very, very typical Sunderland. But a friend of mine at the university actually knitted me a David Hodgson doll. It's probably only one of those, and David Hodgson really ought to have it. But that was my kind of David Hodgson thing. What one question for you, which I think it'd be interesting on your perspective. You know, having had a career, 12, 13 teams you played for, Scotland, England, you even played in Japan, but you're now in the world of broadcasting. And I guess one of the things that Darren and I would love to see was broadcasters actually paying more attention to some of the innovation that the clubs are doing in and around the match day. So we're not talking about community visits. They do get a lot of focus. You know, when the various sports broadcasters are short of content, you often see a lot of things like, especially around Christmas, hospital visits, community programs. A lot of clubs do great things around staying away from railway tracks, knife crime, you know, inclusion, self-esteem and things like that. But we do see a lack of focus on the imaginative things that clubs are doing around the match day. Do you think that will change in time?
Well, it's interesting. The one thing in the broadcaster's defense that I can tell you is that you are restricted in the build-up to games. I mean, when I'm doing the analysis, for instance, there are some matches where you get a 10-minute build-up before kickoff, and there are others where you get a 45-minute build-up before kickoff. And, you know, even the 45-minute time before kickoff, it can sometimes just whiz by and you don't really feel like you've had an opportunity to make some of the points that you'd like to. So from that perspective, I have to sort of understand and explain to people that they, you know, that the time of fitting that into an actual live match might not be available. But the one place where it would be available, guys, is on the Sky Sports News platform, or even the news platform, where you want to try and encourage you know, broadcasters to show the world. And I'm not just talking about Sky Sports, I'm talking about all broadcasters. What wonderful initiatives that clubs are coming up with in order to give their fans the best experience possible. Darren, I think it was you mentioning about Disney, was it? Or was it you, Mark? One of you was mentioning Disney, and the way they do things, having experienced it, is they just want to make your experience as special as it possibly can be. And, you know, they do an awful good job at that. And I think football clubs are slowly but surely, as you said, I think some do it better than others, but the more we talk about it, the more it brings it into focus. And hopefully the more it will encourage those that don't do it as well to try and up their game a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Disney thing, it is really important, you know, that people often compare, you know, sport. We can learn a lot from Disney, and we can, you know, we can do a lot of the things Disney do. You know, Disney have realized that people drop litter instinctively, maybe every 30, 40 yards if they don't see a waste bin. And so what Disney did was make sure that their waste bins are, you know, 30, 40 yards apart. So no one ever goes, you know, walks long enough, too long, or long enough to the point where they want to drop something. But it's because it's in their DNA. It's what they exist for. You know, with Disney, it's we exist, you know, to delight kids, to make them smile. And football, you know, has there's an association with winning that creates a sense of aggression and assertion across the club. And while that's really important on the pitch, it sometimes gets in the way of more positive interactions off the pitch. And I think that's something that football's learning to get to grips with now. We're still, you know, still far away from seeing every club have somebody who is a fan engagement officer. We do have things called supporter liaison officers, but there is still, I think, an opportunity for football to move further along the road. It can't ever be Disney. Disney is Disney and football's football, but we can do a lot more. I think Darren would agree with that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just some of the principles. I know that some of the training that we've done, Mark, with clubs has sort of suggested that we're not saying there should be Disney and do the same things as Disney, but the principles are almost identical, and that's really just putting the fan, if you like, in the football club's case, at the center of the experience. And I think for too long, perhaps there'd been a sort of a tendency to put the outside almost as if they were just a spectator. And I think one of the biggest things that's starting to happen in the last few years is that clubs are seeing that actually the whole experience is about much more than the 90 minutes, and therefore they have to think of what the fans want and need and are going to enjoy for much longer than just the game itself.
So I guess over the next, you know, the next few podcasts, and we've got, you know, plenty lined up, as we said at the start, we're going to look at some of these areas in a lot more detail, you know, from the experience of a mum taking her kids to the very first game. You know, what does a club's website need to do to help there? How do you keep that in, you know, in age group of 11 to 17? How do you keep them coming to games, you know, when they've got pressing needs such as making money if they're going away and do full-time study? And, you know, there are so many pressures. So we look at those individual touch points, and we'll have different podcasts on them. And we'll also you know, take the time, as I said, to have some specials. But it's you know, it's really been an honour to have you, and we can't let you go, Dom, without each of us having an opportunity to share some of our magic memories of you, you know, when you were a player. And I'll let Darren start. You know, Darren's been a Walsall fan all his life, and of course you crossed paths for a couple of seasons a few years ago. Darren, what were your best memories of Don?
Well, I mean, Don will know this. There's only one place I could possibly go, and that's Cardiff. Because I always say, Don, that and Walsall basically won the playoff final at the Millennium Stadium. And I think we probably, if I'm right, Don, probably only led in the game for about 5 or 6 minutes of the entire 2 hours that the game went on. Yeah. So I often describe it for me as a fan, from a fan experience, as one of the most nerve-wracking and nail-biting experiences ever, with 6 minutes of feeling great. But obviously you got the equaliser in that game. So you know, without that, we might not have even got to extra time. So I can only thank you for that.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I mean, I have to say, on that day, I was 35 years old at the time. And although Walsall, with respect to Walsall, weren't one of the most glamorous clubs that I represented during my career, that right there, Darren, was my best moment in football, literally. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I had a 20-year career, and that right there, the feeling that you get from such a special occasion and achieving goals, and then you share that feeling with the fans, sensational, absolutely sensational.
My memory of you, Don, I mean, you know, Sunderland's an interesting club. I think there's no club that has, I think there was some research yesterday, we're the 10th best supported club in history in English football. And yet we've only ever played 2 games in Europe in 1973, you know, so no European football for 47 years. And yet still there, you know, the 10th best supported team. So our fans are, we're kind of not glory hunters. You know, Sunderland, the values are about hard work. And you'll know people like, going back, Alex Ray, Kevin Ball, you know, people like that were, you know, really, really, even Lee Catamole in, you know, more recent days. They're the type of people that were icons for us. And you're another example of that, you know. So we had, you know, Marco Gabbiadini before you. You both must have done some broadcasting together. And he would just set off chest out from the halfway line and knock anybody over who happened to be in the way. Then you came along and did exactly the same thing. And I think a testament to how much you were loved is that we didn't come up with a sort of Mickey taking T-shirt for you, because you would have played with Martin Smith, son of Pele.
Indeed, yeah, you've got it.
Yeah, and I think you also played with Ole, 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 Phil Gray. In fact, I know you did, because my greatest memory of you was the pair of you together dismantling Leeds at Elland Road. I think it might have been a cup game, but I know there was the hat-trick against Millwall in the 6-2 win, but that was a fantastic memory, because, as you know, Leeds and Sunderland, big rivals for many years, and you put on a fantastic performance that day. And our producer, who is listening in, is Juan. He's the Bradford City fan, and you know, he's only 24 now, so obviously he didn't get a chance to see you play. But you know, when he looks back, you know, he sees you as a huge part of Bradford City. And I thought it might be a nice moment just for you to recollect Trevor Cherry, who we lost this week. Yeah. Because I believe it's true that it was Trevor that gave you your first opportunity in football.
Yeah, well, if I may, before I come on to Trevor, I'd like to pay homage to the Sunderland fans, because until you go and you represent them, people will try and describe you to you the passion that they have, but there aren't any words really, Mark, to be honest with you. Like you said, they've been through the mill an awful lot, both in days gone by and in recent times, and I loved my time up there. I loved playing for them. They embraced me. They took me into their hearts. And I think nothing epitomises it more than my experience last May, when they just lost the League One playoff final. I had done the commentary, and I was walking up the hill at Wembley afterwards, and literally, without hesitation, there were dads and guys coming up to me and telling their sons, "This used to be a hero of ours," and blah, blah, blah. They just lost in the League One playoff final. And you know what? They are the kind of fans that once they've got you in their hearts, that they don't let you out. And I always get really well received whenever I go up there and speak. So I love Sunderland Football Club. I love Sunderland fans. I really, really, truly do. And if I may, on a note with regards to Trevor Cherry, it was such a horrible shock. My heart goes out to his wife and his family. And if it weren't for him, we may not be having this conversation. I was an apprentice electrician at the time that he gave me my debut. I was 17, and then offered me a professional deal at Bradford City. And more than that, he nurtured me. He would take me out of the firing line after 6 or 7 games because I wasn't used to professional football. But he really, really looked after me, and he taught me an awful lot along with Terry Orth, his assistant. So if it weren't for Trevor Cherry, and funny enough, I created a little WhatsApp group of the Bradford City players of that day, and we all paid homage to him, and he was so influential in nearly all of that team's success, and not just the success that they had at the time, but the success that they would go on to have. There were some great players within that went on to have wonderful, wonderful careers, like Sir Stuart McCall and John Hendry, just to name but two. So we all owe Trevor Cherry an awful lot. I will be forever indebted to him, and you know, he will be sadly missed.
Well, thanks, Don.
Time for the roundup.
And as we promised earlier, we have a little roundup. And so as we'll go forward with these podcasts, we'll have a little roundup every time with something that's either current or something that's in the recent past that we think is a really good example of, you know, fan engagement or fan experience in any of their guises. And the one that Juan Luis has looked up for us this week is Villa. And Villa have Learning with Lions. They have this lovely digital program running over this period so that kids who are Villa fans can actually, you know, do some education and do some learning. And, you know, I met Anna, my other half, studying Spanish. Darren's wife, Luisa, is Italian. And Juan Luis, our producer, is studying Latin American. And what Villa have done is created Learning with Lions, which is a digital learning program which runs over this pandemic. And it means that kids who can't go to school can still get that Villa fix. And in this particular case, it's Bjorn Engels, who is digitally teaching Villa fans how to speak Flemish. So we've had him doing Flemish. We'll have Oyen Newland, who'll be teaching Villa kids how to speak Norwegian, and et cetera, et cetera. And Juan Luis, in his what will become a weekly look through the digital activities of football clubs, will pick more of these up. But we just thought that was a lovely one. It not only connects to showing how football clubs can keep in touch with their fans during this pandemic, but it also shows how, you know, we've got football squads with players from all over the world these days. Modern languages may not be such an important subject at schools. And I think one of the ways that it will get back there at the top is for, you know, is for football clubs to encourage kids to learn languages. And I think we've even got Aston Villa women getting involved in that. But yeah, that was this week's little roundup of what's good in the world of fan engagement. Hats off to Villa for doing that, the Learning with Lions. And I guess at this point, we are coming to the end of the podcast. We're going to be holding and hosting all of the podcasts at www.fanexperienceco.com. That's where you'll be able to access these podcasts. The website will be available soon, so please look out for when that website launches. We'd love you to tune into these websites. We'd love you to ask questions. We'd love you to let us know what you think. We'd love to feature people eventually on the show. So in future weeks, we're going to have special guests, as we say, looking at different touch points and also looking at some of the wider subjects. Darren, do you want to help us bring the show to a close?
Yeah, just to say that the first of the touch points that we're looking at is going to be first impressions, which is always one of my favourite parts of the match day experience, because obviously it starts well before the match day. So we're going to be looking at areas such as the website and how that can influence the match day experience and help to bring more fans to the ground.
Thanks, Darren. And of course, our biggest thank you this week goes to our special guest, our honorary president, one of the Everly brothers, Phil and Don at Sunderland. I forgot to mention that, Don. But, you know, one of our fantastic heroes, but somebody who's, you know, really demonstrated that, you know, players do have an interest in fan experience. The return of football after the pandemic will give them an opportunity to do even more. But we can't thank you enough, Don. Thank you so much for being our first guest.
Well, thanks, Don.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you so much. We'll see you all next time. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you. Take care. See you all soon.
And don't forget to check out our new website at fanexperienceco.com. The Fan Experience Experience was recorded live. See you next time.